into science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and, oh yes, the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. With us this week, journalist, critic, fiction writer, nonfiction writer, Randy Dawn. Stay tuned. Again, good morning. As mentioned, this is Hour of the Wolf. I'm Jim Freund. It is bleeping hot in this room, let me tell you. You know, maybe, baby, it's cold outside, as Bing Crosby used to sing. Did Sinatra ever do that one?
He did the Baby, It's Bleeping Hot in Here version.
Oh, okay. No, then that, you see, that must have been the Capitol era.
Right? Exactly. That's the Capitol era.
Yeah. Okay. You know, that's
big band, you know.
Yeah. But, well, big band with Dorsey.
Mancini, though. You know, the Mancini.
Yeah. Well, you see, that's the thing. It's the Mancini era. We were talking about this off the air, people. It was the Mancini era that where, you know, where he, this is the stuff that Simon Locley, the recently deceased Simon Locley, loved. He just loved Old MacDonald Had a Chick, E-I-E-I-O, you know, and on this, and this chick, and she know, lived on a farm.
Yeah, I know you're down on that, but there is a certain appeal to that. And you know, he had great hats. They're really great hats during that period.
They're great hats. Absolutely great hats. But you know what's really cheap hats is when Mikhail Baryshnikov does a dance to a Sinatra tune, trying to dress like Sinatra. He doesn't get the hat right. He just doesn't do it.
Yeah, but he gets the face right. Mikhail Baryshnikov, oh, the heart, you know.
Well, the Misha, people I know Misha, aren't Misha. Looking at his face. But anyway. Good morning, Randy.
Good morning, Jim. How are you?
So I'm well. I'm well. We had a big event here on the ground floor last night, New York Review of Science Fiction Readings. Not as big as the annual family Delia Sherman Ellen Kushner event that is just so close to my heart
and to mine. Not perhaps as close as yours, but certainly close.
Well, as a producer,
yes.
As a producer of the events that we hold now here at 388 Atlantic. Mm-hmm. But we had, I mean, it for some reason, our January readings are always like on the coldest day of the year. 2 years ago, when we were still at the Soho Gallery for Digital Art, the day we had the reading was the day of that polar vortex. Do you remember that?
I do. I remember the words anyway.
Yes, that was for one day, and that was our day. And yet, we got something like 15, 20 people braving, and I mean braving, the weather and the wind and the slippery streets. And last night, it was in the 20s, which wasn't as bad as the day before, where it was in the teens.
Right.
But we got about 35 people to see Maria Devonna Headley and Terrence Taylor.
Well, if I am correct, perhaps in saying this, if it goes on this way, you may need to have a fashion consultant who comes out and takes pictures and contacts all the style papers, because now the dressing for the occasion has become
It really has. Terrence didn't. People. By the way, if people missed either of these two events, or some of the earlier ones, you can see them. You can set your Wayback Machine. After the show is over and after Lister's show is over, you want to listen to Lister, Burn Baby Burn Clappers. And you go to livestream.com and you click on the part that says watch, not broadcast. Believe me, you don't want to do that. You go to the watch part and then you search. Boy, this mic pops its peas, even with the windscreen. And then you search for the name of the reading series, which is NYRSF, NYRSF, New York Review of Science Fiction Readings. And you can see there's about 9 readings up there at this point. Although I think I'm going to, down the line, create a YouTube channel.
Yeah.
And there's been some buzz and some technical issues. Delia's mic was dropping out last month.
Yeah, I remember that.
And that's a problem also on the actual video.
Right.
However, I had my own recording.
Right. Well, you should also tell people where they can find wonderful pictures, because they need to see both Ellen Kushner's dress.
Facebook.
And Ms. Headley's.
Maria Davana Headley's
thank
dress.
Thank you very much. Her dress was even more fabulous. Sorry, Ellen.
Well, the two of them, I'm sure they know each other.
Yeah.
Oh, no, not sure. I know they know each other.
Yeah.
Because I know that Ellen went to Maria's Christmas party.
Ah, there you go.
I know that because Ellen didn't come to mine this year. She came to mine last year. And Maria and I had ours on the same night.
Well, I thoroughly enjoyed your Christmas party, so thank you for
inviting
me.
But Maria and I have already achieved detente that we're going to do them on separate nights.
Okay, would that be detente?
That's what I thought you had said, yes. Something like that. Indeed. For those people who missed you on our Thanksgiving program, tell them who I am. Who you are.
Well, Jim, no. My name's Randy Dawn, and I've been an entertainment critic for a lot of years for outlets including The Today Show, for Variety, for LA Times Envelope, a lot of different places. So I write about a lot of film and TV. My heart is in my fiction, and I am trying to move that signal along a bit more.
A lot of that is genre fiction.
Yeah, genre fiction primarily, although I have some crimes. I guess crime is also another
genre. It is genre.
So, a lot of different types of genre fiction that I'm working on.
And there's the speculative genre fiction, and then there is the crime. I guess crime would be the word, whether it's a procedural or a whodunit or a detective story. Crime is generally involved, right. Or intrigue might be another word.
Right. Yeah, I got very heavily into Law and Order and its heyday, and I ended up doing co-authorship with Susan Green of
the
Law and Order SVU Unofficial Companion. And that really got me into the concept of writing crime fiction. So I have all this crime fiction sitting around, but I got very into reviving an urban fantasy novel that I had written about 10 years ago, and that is what I am working on finding a home for that right now. I may have a home for it.
So oh, good.
Crossing
good.
Fingers on that.
Knock wood. Exactly. I have had the I've been doing a lot of audio editing and audio book editing of late, and I got to do, we were talking about the committee, it was never called the Rat Pack.
Well, outside there was a Rat Pack, it's just a different collection of books.
I've done 2 of the Matt Helm novels.
Ah.
And I was, now, the Matt Helm movies are like, the leeringest, that's a good word, the leeringest of those bikini, great actors surrounded by bikinis, Lee J. Cobb, all these people getting a good payday.
Would you say it veers from Lear into Lech? Are we actually going into
Lech
territory?
Yeah. Okay. Oh, yeah. Yeah, okay. Very much so.
Okay.
Very much so. Dean Martin at the head of it all, with the round bed that just dumps all the inhabitants of it, and there are several into the swimming pool for the, in their lingerie and stuff like that. And
right.
Matt Helm is a fashion photographer. So when I was told by the people that I work with at Skyboat Media that I could, you know, do a Matt Helm novel, that I could pick them up. I'm going, okay, it's work. And I was shocked at how good they are. They're really good, well written, credible, credible, as like John le Carré.
Right.
Is credible. You know, Le Carré versus Fleming. Fleming is not credible. Le Carré is.
Yeah, exactly. It's two different types of spy novels for sure. And we could have a whole conversation on Fleming.
And Matt Helm. And we have, yes.
And
Donald Hamilton was yet another. And he was more in the Le Carré world of stuff, although not, almost equally cynical.
Oh, okay.
Except American as opposed to British.
Right. Well, American cynicism, I think, is a different breed than British cynicism.
Very much so. But Le Carré actually turned – but you know, Le Carré, being the Brit that he is, was able to turn down the New Year's honor. He decided not to be knighted.
Ah, okay.
And here, I guess, you know, the writers just don't get too many awards from presidents. Obama's done book reviews lately, but that's about, you know.
Yeah, not nearly enough.
Not really. And I think that we ought to find out on the campaign trail what people read.
Yeah, I'll go with that. If, you know, should I happen to have a chance to chat with Bernie or Hillary or...
I wonder what Bernie reads versus Hillary. Hillary, I think we can all agree from what she said when she retired as Secretary of State, that she's very, very much into the DIY type magazines, books, and TV shows. Home building and stuff like that. I'm not being facetious. She really went on and on about this. First time in how many years that she had any time off. Because, of course, when her husband was president, she was, I think, sort of, you know, co-president.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's probably a safe thing to say.
I think so. So, but I wonder what Bernie, I bet you he reads spec fic. I bet you, you know, that not Heinlein necessarily, but
he's
Heinlein.
He's a dreamer, you know, and I think dreamers read spec fic because that's part of where you get that monster fed, you know.
Yeah,
you read
the absolutely.
Spec fic and it just comes back and goes in a circle and feed the monster that way.
And some of the better science fiction can be mighty political. Him, Stanley Robinson, his stuff.
Yeah. Heinlein winner.
Heinlein winner?
Yeah, I think I just read that actually earlier this evening that he won the Heinlein Award.
What is the Heinlein Award?
All right, wait a minute. I will have to look. Okay, ignore me for now.
I'm sure there is one.
I am speaking from which I'm not sure, but I read Scalzi's, John Scalzi's Twitter feed before I went to bed, I got up for this. And I feel like it said congratulations to Kim Stanley Robinson for winning. I thought it was the Heinlein
Award. Maybe there was, but it's an award that I am not familiar with and therefore worthless.
Okay.
But, no, I'm sure there is, and if there isn't, there ought to be.
Yeah.
There's a Cordwainer Smith Award for writers who have unfairly fallen off the face of the map.
Okay.
Basically. And because Cordwainer Smith is, in my mind, one of the great writers of all time.
Mm-hmm.
And probably nobody out there listening has any idea of who he or his real name, Paul Leinbarger, was.
Can I tell you a very brief Kim Stanley Robinson story?
That absolutely.
Has very little to do except with for me. I went to Wisconsin, you know, the convention earlier this year, and earlier last year, because now we're in January, and he was there, and they did the Tiptree auction as well as the Tiptree Awards.
Right.
And at the auction, I went, and there was an Ursula K. Le Guin book, a first edition, a signed thing up for auction. That's my husband's. She's my husband's favorite author ever.
She's about mine. Yeah.
And I thought I'm going to get this for him.
And okay.
Kim was doing the auctioning at the
Stan.
Time because they. I'm sorry.
He calls himself Stan.
All right. See, we're not on a first-name basis. Forgive me on that, Stan.
Okay.
So Stan is doing the actual auctioning of this particular item, and he says, well, if we get to a certain level, he'll do a dance. And I made it get to that level.
Mm-hmm.
I made him do a dance.
Oh, good.
So I got to tell this great story.
And he's a lanky kind of a sort of...
Yeah.
What would you say? Sort of a Joel McRae kind of a guy?
Rangy. Rangy, perhaps.
Yeah.
Go with Rangy. Joel McRae, I think, fits.
Joel McRae, you know, Sullivan's Travel, Joel McRae type. That's...
Yeah.
How I think of Stan very much.
So anyway, so, yeah. that's my little, you know, that's my little story.
And somebody bought Red Mars, one of the worst TV channels in the world, Spike Television, which used to be called Maverick, which is like testosterone TV of the worst order.
You know, I have enjoyed some stuff on Spike, but here's my question. Does that mean that that Syfy has redeemed itself
the syphilis channel.
As being not the worst TV channel anymore?
Spike was always worse than Syfy channel. I didn't like it when they were the Sci-Fi channel either. They didn't they bought, you know, the Jump the Shark episodes of Stargate,
mm-hmm.
To keep it going. And I enjoyed them as guilty pleasure. But they weren't very good. Battlestar Galactica was really, as I understand it, developed for NBC, but NBC at that point owned the Sci-Fi channel and thought that that would be the good outlet for
still
it.
Still do, isn't it, under the umbrella?
Yeah, it's all. But I mean, but at that point was, I think, about when they acquired it.
Oh, okay.
And that's when Battlestar Galactica got moved there. And I only liked Battlestar Galactica for about two seasons.
Mm.
And then, you know, by the time it got to, you know, who's a clone, who's a this, who's a that, who's a Xylon, who's a droid, whatever, I was bored.
Well, this is something I'm hoping we'll get into a little bit later, which is the overarching vision of TV show writers.
Yes.
And do they know where they're going, and should they know where they're going, and if they don't know where they're going, when should they figure it out?
Well, I will tell you one thing that I got from an interview that I did with Ronald D. Moore,
mm-hmm.
who was the runner behind Battlestar Galactica and one of my favorite New Yorker cartoons is of a giant turtle in space. And it just said underneath Battlestar Galactica.
When I was little, my friend and I would watch the original, and for some reason she liked to call it Battlestar Bacteria.
Ooh, that one works as well.
So, yeah.
Especially, you know, and Alpo and all that. But but at any rate,
yes.
Ronald Moore mm-hmm. explained, especially when he was working in the latter days of Star Trek,
mm-hmm.
that he would write the cliffhangers. The big, big cliffhangers. He had no idea how these stories were going to resolve.
Mm.
None whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
No thought to it. And then if the series renewed, which was the whole point of creating such a big deal cliffhanger, then when – and Mike get renewed only about 4 weeks before they had to start shooting,
mm-hmm.
all of a sudden they'd go into a fevered pitch and say, okay, what are we going to do about this? And in the meantime, the writer's room may have totally changed with all new people who said, I wouldn't have set it up that way to begin with.
Right.
So sometimes they have no idea.
Yeah, and I know that it's one of the vagaries of network television, having covered it for so long, that that, you know, you're not in control of your final product most of the time because you don't know if you're going to have a final product or when the final product is. But TV has changed so much that I'm asking more of it these days.
Yeah, and that's something else we can discuss on a future show.
Yep.
Is the future of television, is there a future,
mm-hmm.
or is it all on demand and streaming?
Right.
Because I got to tell you, if it wasn't for Turner Classic Movies at this point, I would have cut the cord. And if ever they put out a channel that you can subscribe to for pay,
mm-hmm.
then that's it. I'm just on my Roku and Chromecast and my various subscriptions to Acorn and to for my Brit shows.
Yeah, I love
and
Acorn.
Yeah, it's wonderful. And Netflix and the various providers that you can get through various places and, you know, save about $80 a month minimum.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I've said more than once that if this wasn't the job, if I didn't have to have the cable at this point, I would cord cut as well.
Yeah, Yeah, that's the other thing. But Turner Classic Movies is just when I turn on the TV, mm-hmm. a lot of people go to the news, some people go to the Weather Channel. I go to Turner Classic Movies. Even when I'm not going to watch the movie they have on, I want to see what the introduction that either Mankiewicz or Osborne are going to do. I love that channel. Mm-hmm. And that's the only reason I haven't cord cut yet.
Yeah.
And by the way, I should just mention to listeners, even though this isn't a pitching week, wait till February. Wait for it. You could save money by cutting the cord and give it to WBAI because...
BAI is awesome!
Wow.
I don't know. What do you want me to say? It's a great place.
It can be. It can be. It was a great place. It's getting good again.
Mm-hmm.
I have a very positive feeling about where a lot of the programming is moving to, mm-hmm. and there will be change. And from what little I know about the change, mm-hmm. I'm very hopeful.
Okay.
And I love, even though our studios are like just an office without walls practically, mm-hmm. or walls but no ceiling, no soundproofing or anything, I really like our location.
So this is the hopey changey thing is what you're saying.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. That is part of it. Part of it. Yeah.
The hopey changey thing. Right.
Yeah. Right. I did not feel good a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
I have to say. And now I do.
Good.
Now, this is the problem. I enjoy talking to you too damned much. And last time we didn't have time for you to read a story.
We still can't read the exact story I'd like to read, but that's quite all right. We're going to save that for the holidays.
That's for the next holiday.
For a holiday
and what I will do is I will try to arrange for a little more airtime because that story runs about an hour or a little more.
Oh,
right?
No, it'll be half an hour. Half an hour, I think.
How many words?
About 5,000.
45 minutes.
Okay.
45 minutes, and that's only if you're reading too fast.
Okay.
And so you should slow down.
Well, hopefully I would read it at the right pace.
I always tell people, I had an argument about this last night with Maria Devana Headley. I said, slow down. She says, I read at a proper speed. And she did very, very, very well.
Mm-hmm.
But most writers reading their own work.
Right.
And actually, Terrence was very good, too,
mm-hmm.
because he knows how to pull a laugh and stuff like that. But so many people reading their own work, they get not exactly shy, but they're a little more subdued.
Yeah. I'm sure there are plenty of writers who've gotten over that, but it's kind of like, ooh, this is my stuff. You know, you get very possessive of it.
People like Ellen Kushner, you know, she's a radio pro.
Well, she's got radio in the blood.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, NPR and those people.
Mm-hmm.
Those nasty people.
I briefly worked for NPR. I don't have any.
Well, the person who created the show, of course, is Margot Adler, who was, yeah.
NPR.
One of the, all things considered.
Right, exactly.
So close enough.
Close enough for jazz.
Yeah. Or actually what we always say around here, close enough for radio. But close enough for jazz is probably where that phrase begins.
Is it?
Okay. I'm at a guess.
We should look. Maybe you'll look that up while I'm doing the story.
I'd have to go to phrases.org. Phrases.co.uk. It's my favorite place for things like that.
Mm.
And so, yeah.
He's got a key out. Hold
why
on.
Is he taking out his keys? And the answer is because my music is on my keychain.
Oh, okay.
And I have a particular Harry Belafonte song.
Oh, right. Yes. So we did discuss this, yes.
That I wanted to play. So I put it on my keys. The keys, yes, I think it's C sharp. Anyway.
Yes. Songs in the key of his keychain.
Yes, exactly. All of you on the radio can see the keys jangling. So is there any, should I get you a, we don't have water here, damn it.
I've got a soda. I'm okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Pardon me.
Uh-oh. Catherine Davis, if you are still here, I have your flash drive.
Uh-oh.
Oh, dear. How will I get it to her? Okay. I'll see her next week, but she probably doesn't want to be without it for a week.
No. I'm sure she'll want it back as soon as possible.
Yeah. At any rate.
It's radio, folks.
Yeah. So would you? So is there? Yeah, but it's freeform live radio in the middle of the night in New York. I know people listening on the other side of the world, and there are people listening on the other side of the world.
Hello, people.
Hi there. I think there are people. We get
hello, sentient beings.
We get calls from. I have a regular listener in Bulgaria who uses Skype to call in.
Hello, Bulgaria listener.
And a couple in Australia.
Good day, mate.
Yeah.
And it is good day over there.
And it is good day over there. It's early afternoon.
We could have a whole conversation about my love affair with Australia. That would be another conversation.
Yeah, it'd be. No, I'm not going to go there.
Okay. All right, then.
We've had two Australian program directors here. And one of them did a show, a serious show called Investigations. And I used to do my proper announcer thing when his show was going to go on. And I would say, this is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. And now stay tuned for Investigations.
And there was a small rash of hives that were on the arms, I'm sure.
He's the only person who ever suspended me. but that was for a totally different and actually deserved reason.
I see. Okay. So he's plugging in his keychain with the music that is very important for this particular part of the proceedings. And it seems like it should work. Yes.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Very good. Did you want me to introduce or anything? Or?
If there is something that you would like to introduce, also during your reading, I may, with your permission, take a photograph for Instagram.
Please go right ahead.
And open the door. Because this room is, although what difference does it make? We don't have a ceiling.
Yeah.
But
well, it's not going to rain in here. We do have a ceiling, but not a full ceiling.
Yeah, there's a roof garden that's gorgeous.
We should be recording up here.
I want to do a show live from there.
Why
absolutely.
Not? Why not?
We haven't done it yet.
If that other station can have the green space, you can have the roof space.
Yep, absolutely.
So
I've still never been to the green space.
Neither have I.
Yeah,
I just heard about this.
Yeah, but I want to.
So by way of introduction, this is a short story called Can't Keep a Dead Man Down, which I wrote a couple of years ago and was actually turned into a podcast for Well Told Tales, a late lamented pulp fiction podcast run by Kevin Colligan, who certainly deserves all the credit I can possibly give him because he published this one and one other one of mine. And that's pretty much it takes place in Baltimore, which is not super important to the story, but I'm from Maryland, so I like to give Baltimore a little fish.
You're from Gaithersburg.
Gaithersburg, Maryland.
The
right.
Last con I went to was Capclave in
Capclave,
Gaithersburg.
Right, yes, exactly. It's funny to me that it's called Capclave because it stands for capital, and Gaithersburg's not the capital of anything.
No, but you see, it used to be Disclave for District of Columbia.
Right.
And that was also in Maryland. Uh-huh. No, I take that was at the Sheraton Park.
Oh, okay.
So that was in D.C. But the New York convention is in Rye instead of New York City and all that.
Exactly. So. You get where the you book the hotel where you can book the hotel.
Yeah, exactly.
So I get that. But anyway, so that I just like to give a little shout out to Maryland because growing up, I was like, nothing ever happens in Maryland, not on TV and movies. And now it does, you know, thanks to the X-Files and so forth. Anyway, shall I begin or are you playing music or what are we doing?
I've already cut off my mic.
Okay, good. Can't Keep a Dead Man Down by Randy Dawn. Dark. Dark and hot and crowded and oh my God, I want to move but I can't. Stuck inside this dream, I'm not awake and not asleep. I know exactly where I am and it's a warm, sticky place where I'm thinking about writing. So my hand is twitching like there's a pen in it. But my eyes won't open and it's dark and I keep squirming and thinking I'm going to wake up. Wake up, wake up. I'm up. Awake, I think. Voices. Muffled, strained. Sounds I know, but they're both distant and near, the way I was both asleep and awake. Coming through layers of cotton, of wool, of something moist. Heavy and moist. Hell if I know what they're saying. Deja vu, like I never felt before. This wave just came over me. Been here, done this, leave a good-looking corpse, ha ha. Better than Boujade, like George Carlin would have said, that feeling that none of this has ever happened before. Ha ha. Laugh riot, that's me. Just woke up and I'm cracking the old ones. Cracking bones. Oh, it's a bad morning. Something's sitting on top of me, and it's so dang dark in this room, as if my eyes are open, but they're not, because there's many comforters on top of me. That'd be par for the course. That's Sheila all the way for you, 1 degree below 60, and she's got hypothermia, grew up in Florida, and no tolerance. So it's like sleeping next to a mummy with all her blankets and heating pads and body pillows. Wraps up so tight, when we want to screw, I gotta unpeel her like a banana to get to the meat, if you know what I mean. I think you know what I mean. But Christ, it's dark in here. I know it's daytime, but I can't see a danged thing, and I blink once, twice, three times, just to make sure my eyes are opening and closing, and they are, but let's just peel some of these stupid blankets back. What the hell is that? My hand comes away with some of that moist heaviness crumbling away in my fingers, and the first thing I think is kitty litter. Sheila came with two cats when we shacked up a year ago, but Oliver up and disappeared during the riots, and she swears she hears him mewling in the backyard still and leaves out a tray of food and kitty litter for him. And every day when the food's gone and the litter is scattered all over the grass like snow, she insists Oliver does come back, but I'm pretty dang positive we won't see his black and white face again. In fact, I know it. Lots of S goes missing and it doesn't come back. Happens all the time, happens a lot more these days. Of course, being alive's taken a bit of a spin lately. Used to be a doc that put that icy hot stethoscope on your chest and burned a light in your eyes and pronounced you healthy and living and ready to go out and pay some more bills. But after the riots, well, probably before, but mostly during and definitely after the riots, we all learned how breathing and dilation wasn't necessarily all there was to living. This is definitely not kitty litter. Getting hot in here again. In here. Am I inside something? Am I not sitting on top of my bed with Sheila's suffocating covers holding me down? Answer, stupid, probably not. If S is crumbling in your fingers when you reach up to move away a blanket, well, that's some serious cognitive dissonance going on. A little more force is what's needed here. Reach up, press once, reach up with the other hand, press twice, and... oh, God. Whatever's above me is heavy, and it's cold and moist, and I can't, it's pressing down, and it's over there on my right, and it's over there on my left, and I'm sitting on it, and it's like I'm inside a big rectangle, and when I grab at it, it comes away in my hands like sand, like feces, like... A big chunk tumbles into my mouth mid-gasp, and I spit, I hawk, I expel. But there's plenty of time to taste, and the tasting tells me everything. It's earthy and rotten, strewn with hard bits, and I think of that cookie recipe my sister-in-law made up once, but this tastes nothing like sweet chocolate sandwich cookies, though they're called the same thing. Dirt. Holy S, I'm surrounded by dirt. Who the hell thought this was a good idea? Not Sheila. That woman lost her sense of humor when the cat vanished. She actually thought I had something to do with it, you know. She saw me scoop up the cat when the riots began, and I put him in a nearby trash can. For safety, for Christ's sake, so he wouldn't get skewered by some of those lunatics' pitchforks. And we went to go back and get him. The can was upended, and, well, no Oliver. I'm this close to losing it. I'm not sure why I haven't lost it yet. It's like my brain knows I'm in deep, deep, or a deep hole. Huh? Brains. But the rest of me is cool and rational in S. It's like I've dialed the panic station, but they hadn't picked up the phone yet, so there's nothing to do yet. For a moment, I go completely still and listen. The voices. Now I know why they're muffled. I hear people. I hear someone beyond, and suddenly am positive they know I'm here and they're not even trying to help me out of this dank, dark, dirty place. In the midst of all the quiet, I can almost make out one voice, a high, anxious tone, one from a woman who loves cats and hogs all the covers. The other, and there is another, is Carl, neighbor, house to the right. He's the first one who came over after the riots died down and the fires were mostly under control, but even though he only had to go 2 feet from his front door to ours, he brought a shotgun. You did better these days if you had some kind of firepower. I've a .45 and a shoebox Sheila doesn't know about in the upstairs closet, but that night Carl was the first one I saw carrying a gun openly like that. I mean, we're in Baltimore, and there are plenty of streets where folks keep a wet and hidden under a baggy T-shirt, but not in this part of town. We're the cute, trendy neighborhood. We're not into all that nonsense. Or maybe we just keep our nonsense better hidden, like my gun in the shoebox. So yeah, probably Carl. He came over with his shotgun, and we sat in the dark living room, not nearly as dark as this place I'm in now, on the floor while the sirens made a symphony in the distance and moans played a melody through the streets for hours, and blasts popped on and off all night like it was the 4th of July. We talked about how the world has gone to hell, and then we just sat there and waited, but nothing came, and then Sheila remembered that Oliver was still in the can, and we went out to the can, and it was too late, he was gone. When was that, anyway? Yesterday? Last week? I can't remember. Hungry. It happens. Every time I wake up, I get up, I do two things. Take a leak, then hunt for cereal. I've been up for now how long? Was I even asleep? It's like watching a wave build in the distance, one you know would be incredible to surf, but here you are, standing on dry land, watching it approach, thinking how lovely the day is, and then it turns into a tsunami and you can't run away fast enough. That's what the freakout feels like, and when it crashes over me, I have no control. If I could see, I'd see it red, and it goes all bone white, and I'm reaching up and clawing at the dirt, peeling away huge clods and pushing them to the side. It's all pretty solid packed around me, but above is soft and malleable, and I can grab the pieces, and if I only had some place to put them, I could make headway, and I'm so danged hungry. Not bad. So I eat the dirt, and I swallow it, rocks and grass and earthworms whole, and it goes down not too horrible. I just grab and squish and push and gag it down, and suddenly there's all the room in the world, because I'm not getting full, and I gotta get out from under whatever's on top of me. Nothing is more important than getting at those voices. Carl and Sheila, you are both due for a great big shutting up. In fact, before I do get to Sheila and bash open that pretty little head to reveal those squishy, squirming brains, I might just tell her that, in fact, I did see Oliver one last time. He stumbled into the backyard a couple of days after the fires were mostly out, but the city still smelled like burning tires, putting one great gray dirty paw in front of the other in an unsteady, wobbly way like he was drunk. His eyes were yellow, I remember that, and that seemed funky because Oliver's had always been blue. I laughed for a minute, coming into the backyard for a quick smoke, seeing this drunk kitty. I thought it'd be fun to video it for the internet, but the internet was gone like the electricity, and I got all emotional and the cigarette dropped out of my fingers. So I never did like that cat, but I reached over to scoop him up, tell him it'd be okay. We had food in the house, and suddenly it was like there was a fire in my neck. He'd sunk his teeth into me and missed the jugular, but it was enough to hurt like an SOB, and I flung him off me like a dirty shirt, and he took away a trunk of my shoulder with him. Blood. There was a fair amount of blood, and that was definitely not a good thing, especially these days. I grabbed the first thing I could get a hold of, a big heavy shovel we used last spring to make a garden that never took, and I slammed it down on the animal's head once, twice, three times, and he was still hissing. God, what a miserable sound. He was hissing the whole time, and it was like he wouldn't die. And then he was quiet. I lifted the shovel to reveal the bloody mass of cat that remained and realized the edge had severed his pulped head from his body, and I turned and vomited into Sheila's outdoor kitty litter box. I vomited until it was just dry heaves, and then I got a whiff of charred city and my spew and bloody cat, and I think I about fainted. Didn't, though. Got rid of the cat instead. Tossed him in the back in that trash barrel he escaped from and burnt him up. Crispy. Nobody noticed the smell, not when it matched the perfume Baltimore had worn for a week or two by then. Then I buried him, cleaned myself up, went to bed. Woke up here, in the dark. For a second I have this crazy notion, even as I'm chawing down on my latest handful of dirt clod, yes, even more insane than eating dirt, and I think, holy crap, am I the cat? Do I have 9 lives? A tiny fistful of dirt dissolves into my face, and there it is, light. Not a lot of it, more the absence of darkness, but a brighter gray, a whiff of burning and tires and Baltimore. I push a triumphant fist through the opening and flex my fingers. I'm almost out of here. And the voices. They're clear now. Sheila, a high-pitched wail of anguish. And Carl, gagging, terrified. Jesus Christ, I hear him say. I giggle, thrusting my head through the hole, dirt crumbs dribbling out of the corners of my mouth. Not quite, I think. Sheila, mid-wail. Why won't he stay down, Carl? Why won't he just stay down? Can't keep a dead man down, I think, and then I am reborn.
Oh, I Jumpy Jamboree took place in a New York cemetery. It was a zombie jamboree, took place in a New York cemetery. Zombies from all part of the island, some of them was great Calypsonians. Since the season was carnival, they get together in Bacchanal and they singing back to back, belly to belly. Don't give a damn, I done that already. Back to back, belly to belly at the zombie jamboree. You hear me talking, back to back, belly to belly. I don't give a damn, I done that already. Oh, back to back, belly to belly at the zombie jamboree. One female zombie wouldn't behave. See how she jumping out of the grave. In one hand she holding rum, with the other hand she knocking conga drum. The lead singer start to make his rhyme, while the other zombies rattling in time. One bystander had this to say, it was a trick to see the zombies break away. And they singing back to back, belly to belly. Don't give a damn, done it already. Oh, back to back, belly to belly at the zombie jamboree. Hey, you talking, back to back, belly to belly. Don't give a damn, I done it already. Oh, back to back, belly to belly at the zombie jamboree. Now I must speak to Miss Bridget Bardot and say, Miss Bardot, take it slow. Cause all the men think they're Casanova when they see that she's barefoot all over. Even old men out in Topeka find their hearts are getting weaker and weaker. So we must ask her, for your sake and mine, at least wear her earrings part of the time. And we're singing back to back, belly to belly. Don't give a damn, done it already. Oh, back to back, belly to belly at the zombie jamboree. Once again now, back to back, belly to belly. Don't give a damn, done it already. Back to back, belly to belly at the zombie jamboree. Now they beaten war drums in the Congo, and the beatniks are beating the bongo. So it's up to us, you and me, to put an end to this catastrophe. We must appeal to their goodness of heart, to pitch in and all do their part. Cause if this atomic war begin, they won't even have a part to pitch in. And we'll be singing back to back, belly to belly. We don't give a damn, done there already. Back to back, belly to belly at the zombie jamboree. Hey, you talking, back to back, belly to belly, don't give a damn, done that already. Oh, back to back, belly to belly at the zombie jamboree. A little softer. Cover up with the dirt.
Belly to belly, don't give a damn. Hey, that one is your foot sticking out. Really, oh no, back to back. Belly to belly at the zombie jamboree.
He was more than just about bananas. Is.
Really?
He's still with
is.
Us.
Is. He's still with us. Very much so. His voice, though, whoops. his voice, though, is not what it was. When you hear him talk, he's generally very hoarse.
Yeah.
But he's around. I was once in a restaurant, mm-hmm. and I saw him eating in the restaurant, and he was an elegant, elegant man.
Mm-hmm.
Elegant man. I don't remember which album. Oh, yes, it tells me. The name of the album was Who's Going to Be Your Man? Also, actually,
have
I first...
Have we said Harry Belafonte yet?
I think I said Harry okay. Belafonte, yeah. Okay. and the name of the song is Zombie Jamboree. It was also very popular with the Kingston Trio. They uh-huh. used to go around and do it at the Hungry Eye and all their... But the Calypso version that, even though it's set in a New York... cemetery.
Mm-hmm.
It's the it's Belafonte that gives it that right. real. And I could not understand why. Mm-hmm. It's like the only major Harry Belafonte song that is not in Beetlejuice.
Oh, right. Yeah. Well, the Jump in the Line song we actually played at my wedding. I love that.
Oh,
song.
Yeah. It's so great. But I mean, but of all songs not to play in Beetlejuice mm-hmm. is the one song that Belafonte sang that befitted.
You know, I don't know why they wouldn't include it. Maybe he felt it was too on point. You know, Tim Burton.
With Tim Burton, who knows?
Who knows?
He's talking about somebody who needs to get back on point. But at any rate, yes. This is Hour of the Wolf over WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. Mm-hmm. And if this weren't live radio, I could go back and edit out that long but now you've heard it, so it's too late. And with me is Randy Dawn.
Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning to everybody.
Yeah, and it's actually, you know, it's actually a very pleasant time of day. We have to do this darned all this information
right.
For, and I, well,
it's paperwork without the paper.
It's paperwork without the paper. And while you are engineering your own freeform show,
yeah,
in which I might play a song and not even know what I'm going to play, I have to put in artist, label, song title, album, and, you know, how many grooves were on the original record before it was made digital.
Does the word record graffiti mean anything to you?
Not offhand. It has a vague reverberation.
Okay, so anybody who had vinyl records, we're talking vinyl only.
And I still have lots of vinyl at home.
On the most interior ring that is not a song, there's
right.
always that very smooth ring on
the
interior.
End groove.
Quite often, people would write something. The band, the artist, there are words there. Not everybody, but quite often. And one of my big treats when I would get a new album back in the day, because I still bought albums, was when there would be some piece of album graffiti, and sometimes it would just be a word, sometimes it would be a phrase, sometimes it would be a reference to something. I think the Beatles did it, and I don't know if they were the first.
Definitely on the White Album.
Yeah. So, and, you know, if you have any vinyl...
Before it streamed, folks.
Right, exactly. This is one of the lost Easter egg-y type things, because you didn't get it on... You're sure not going to get it on 8-track. You're not going to get it on cassettes. You're not going to get it on CDs because you can't do anything special on CDs.
My favorite thing were albums which had two sides on one side. There were a couple. I think Python did one.
So is the opposite side the just...
No, well, there were two starting grooves.
Oh, right. Yes, I do know about that.
So there would be like... it would seem like half length would only be about 15 minutes. But if you drop the needle mm-hmm. at the start, mm-hmm. you might get a totally different set of audio. It's concentric rings going inside. So you had two tracks on the end. And there was, of course, famous end groove music that where somebody might hold a note or something.
Mm-hmm.
And because it would be on the end groove in the middle, mm-hmm. where the needle would just keep going, you could play it forever.
Right, right, yeah.
And we at WBAI did such things occasionally. We had our chief engineer, a fellow by the name of Mike Edel,
mm-hmm.
had to do transmitter work every so often. And so don't you get started. It's my little droid here. It starts talking at inappropriate times. Shut up.
And beeping.
Shut up. Yeah. Thinks it's a BB-9 or something.
The singularity has happened right now.
Exactly. Exactly. Except we're in stereo, so there's no singularity. The
band name, Stereo Singularity. It's all yours.
Ooh, it's a good one. Yeah. He once created his own end groove of the Elton John song Rocket Man. And he played the song, and he got it a perfect edit to the point of, and I think it's going to be a long, long time.
Mm-hmm. And it just kept going and going and going at that point?
For 4 hours. For 4 hours on the air. And during that time, he calibrated equipment, he worked in the transmitter,
Let me flash. You're mentioning about working in radio, and I'm just going to ask you this question because it also, in a way, it reflects back on the subject matter I was talking about in my story. Have you seen the movie Pontypool?
No, I haven't even heard of the movie Pontypool.
Pontypool is, it's a strange name, but it's meant to be a small town in Canada where this takes place. It almost entirely takes place in real time in a Canadian radio station. And while our flamboyant DJ is doing his flamboyant DJ thing, it's kind of morning drive time, even though He's a little bit more flamboyant than your average morning drive person.
That's saying something.
Weird and horrible things start going on in the world, and they start getting calls in from people who are suddenly turning cannibalistic and mobbing a doctor's office. And you're not seeing this happen. You're hearing it through the people calling in and the DJ talking about it. And again, it's kind of all takes place in real time, and it's very interesting to see how they work through the mystery of what this is and what's the transmitter in terms of why this is, what's the vector, I guess, when they talk about disease and how disease is transmitted, the vector, how they figure out what that is. And it's,
is it visual? Because it sounds like it would make better radio drama.
Well, it could very well be. Well, the thing is, it's all in the radio station.
Yeah.
You know, there's people who come into the station. It could be like a one-man stage play, too.
Yeah.
You know, one of these things. It's more than one person is in there. But in any
case. But you see, I think audio drama. It's just.
Well, exactly. It could totally work that way, especially since it's in a radio station. It reminds me of Bogosian, you know, talk radio and all that stuff. But it's scary without being too gory. And you can watch it on Netflix. That's where I just saw it. But in any case, you've kind of got a zombie.
I'm going to have to look that one up. Yeah. It sounds real interesting.
Pontypool. Pontypool.
And how do you spell that?
Ponty. P-O-O-L? I think it
okay.
is just as
yeah.
it sounds.
The biggest problem with this plethora of streaming television and stuff are finding the hidden gems, finding... I just discovered, if I see like an FX in a free channel or something like... I know that means Fox, and so I generally... stay away. Although Fox News is not the same as 20th Century Fox
and yeah.
Fox Entertainment, but it just always leaves, you know, it's like, I don't want to give them the hits. But nevertheless, I found on, you know, free play, free movies on demand from Fox Movie Classics.
Mm.
They have like 30 bad Lloyd Nolan comedy mystery films, Mike Shane, Private Detective, and things like that. No commercials.
Okay.
There are at the beginning and end, but no interruptions or anything.
Yeah.
And it's like, I know there are a few websites and things like that, like The Decider, and they're not bad, but it's just so impossible. Netflix went, they have made their navigation and the discovery of things that you like so poor.
See, I like my user experience, as they call it, the UX. I like my user
UI.
Experience. Oh, but for some reason they call it UX, but in any case.
User interface.
Right, exactly.
Or UDI, user design, having worked for a interface design group.
Right, exactly. So UI or UX, however you look at it.
I guess to the consumer it's UX, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But I like Netflix. I recently got a subscription to Hulu, and I'm finding Hulu very hard to navigate.
Yeah.
So.
And again, I don't subscribe because it's Fox!
I got a free subscription to Hulu because I'm in the media.
It's Fox. Well, yeah. Well, but so, in theory, I ought to be able to as well, in theory. But I don't do that. I don't clamber. I let other people at WBAI clamber for who gets the screenings, who gets to go to the theater, who gets to do this, and who gets to do that. Only very rarely will I do that. And I do occasionally.
Well,
very.
You're going to hear the world's smallest violin playing right now. So if we had a cue, I would say play that sound. But yeah, screenings can be a real pain to go to, though. I mean, in there you got to go out. You got to go. You know,
they're in the middle of the day.
But they're in the middle of the day. I live in Brooklyn. It takes an hour to get there. It's an hour back. It's, you know, it's a couple hour movie. It's like, oh, all of a sudden, it's a 5 hour chunk out of your day.
Well, BAI had a fellow by the name of Paul Winder, one of my favorite people. We called him Doc. He is a science teacher in the Bronx, but he was chief announcer of BAI, and he was a movie critic. He was a movie critic beyond belief. The worse the movie, the more he liked it. One of his favorite films was Dr. Butcher, M.D., and the slogan of the movie, the tagline was, is the doctor is insane. And he really liked bad movies.
Oh, sure.
And so he would get quoted. And so you would see in the newspapers these ads for these miserable movies. Best movie of the year, WBAI radio. And stuff. It got to the point where Jay Leno
right.
actually did in his early days at the Tonight Show saying, "Who the bleep is Paul Wonder? Who is this guy?" 60 Minutes did the segment on him because he went to dinner with the producer at the Four Seasons.
Okay.
And they had a hidden camera to show how he was being bought off and all that stuff. And okay. Paul's reaction was, did they bother to note that I gave the movie that person put out a very bad review? And actually, Paul didn't intend to do bad reviews because he always felt that it was his job to guide people to stuff that he thought was cool. Mm-hmm. So why spend time on stuff that he didn't like? He called out a movie that nobody had heard of. It had been playing for a month and was getting ready to move on and close, called The Crying Game. And because he really got behind it, because it's a Neil Jordan film mm-hmm. and all that, he gave that thing a signal boost.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that it wouldn't have become known without him, but, you know, his name was the name on one of the best films ever made. And you know what? He was right.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, Doc died some years ago. Too many joyful moments of recreational use. Let's put it this way. One of the shows he did was called The Drug Program, and it was pretty much first-hand experience.
I see.
And his co-host was David Brown. No, Bruce Brown, whose father was David Brown, and whose mother was Helen Gurley.
Ah, okay.
But David Brown is in Zanuck Brown Productions.
Ah.
They did a movie called Jaws and Close Encounters and all that.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, there's a real joy in enjoying bad movies.
And yeah, but Paul went to 4 or 5 screenings a day.
Okay, I don't have that much time.
His eyes were bloodshot.
I've been to film festivals where I've gone, I think, max 3 a day.
Yeah, no, Paul.
And the thing is, I've forgotten what I've seen in the first one by the time I get to the third one.
Yeah.
Because did that happen in the first movie or did that happen in the third movie? It's like, I don't know how you keep that stuff straight.
Yeah, Roger Ebert once wrote an article, which I thought was very good, about trying to keep – he had seen so many bad movies in a row that he saw a movie that was above mediocre, and he gave it a rave review.
He was so grateful.
He had lost all perspective that he later on – and he named the film apologized for giving it a good review.
Right, right, yeah. No, but, you know, there is that joy in fun movie. And one of the great things about bad movies is that Mystery Science Theater is going to come back and do
So I hear, yeah, well, that's been a rights issue because Max Schmid here at BAI, he's like the MST3K guru. I watch Mystery Science Theater on there's an internet channel called Pluto.
Oh, okay.
Riff Tracks is
separate. But
yeah, Pluto is a channel on your Roku or your Android or your Apple device.
I have to look this up.
Okay, and Pluto has about 100 channels,
mm-hmm.
and one of them is nonstop, 24 hours a day. MST3K.
That I did not know.
Not Riff Tracks.
Okay.
But post Joel.
Okay.
The puppeteer who created the show in the first place.
I thought he was a juggler.
He's a puppeteer. He built those puppets.
I guess that makes sense.
He created Crow. Those are his puppets.
Okay.
By hand.
Yep.
He had been doing routines with them for years before MST3K.
Okay.
And this was just one of his bits mm-hmm. with the puppets, and that's the one that took.
Right.
And then what? After some years, he left, and other people came in and bought the rights, and then I think Joel came back, so some people had to use it under one name, the Riff Tracks, and the other people, and they're doing live shows.
I've been to the live shows. They're fun.
Yeah, well, you probably sat near Max, because he won't miss one of them.
No, those are great. I really enjoy that. That's how I saw The Room.
Okay.
That's how I saw Twilight.
But, yeah, well, Twilight is ripe for that. But the problem is that, for example, the MST3K movie, I like this Island Earth. It's not a piece of trash. Forget Metal Luna. Forget, you know, it's not the world's worst sci-fi film of the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole point of MST3K is that the stuff should be stuff so bad that John Landis would wear a bodysuit before going near it. You know? Really
right.
Bad.
But the point is that this is, you know, another great way to see bad movies, and it's coming
and not
back.
Feel bad about
and
it,
and not feel bad about it. You know, you can look, you can like yourself in the morning.
Yeah, well, I actually watched a Michael Caine movie with Lloyd Nolan last night. I was very, very happy in this discovery. But you wanted to talk about one of my obsessions.
Oh right, yes. This is how this all got started with me coming in. Was Doctor Who is what we wanted to talk about a little bit.
Yeah,
which is. Where this kind of got started was through a Facebook conversation I had with somebody after the Christmas episode of Doctor Who, which aired, you know, just at the end
the
of
most
last
recent.
Year. So if you haven't seen it,
The Husbands of River Song.
Right. So if you haven't seen it, feel free to go and get a cup of coffee or whatever and come back because there may be spoilers. But in any case, so I watched the episode.
There's not that much to spoil in that episode.
No, it's not too much.
The final episode of the season.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's Scott.
That's got stuff.
Spoilers. That's got reveals in
but
it.
But I'm watching
Better
it,
word.
And at the very end, it's like, oh, you know, this will be the last time we can ever meet again. And I'm thinking,
except they did that one already.
You know, well, apparently she's been inscribed in the book that's in the library, and she's got to go back and be in the library, and this is a fixed point, and all this stuff. And
except so easy to pull her out.
Well, and here's my thing, too, and just a disclaimer.
Okay, but yeah, yeah.
My disclaimer is that I am not...
a Whovian.
Who expert. I like Who. It is in the pantheon of many other things that I like. I have watched the vast majority of all the new things, of all the new reboot.
What episodes, we call New Who.
New Who. And watched a smattering of other old Who throughout the years. So this is where I'm coming from. So Jim, I'm hoping...
And most people haven't seen any of the classic Who.
Right.
Although if you have Amazon Prime, mm-hmm. there's actually a good deal of the old episodes...
Right.
On there, as well as I think there's some on Netflix.
Okay.
They use an older TARDIS.
Yeah. There is
an older TARDIS for the logo.
Right, right. So that's where I'm coming from on this. I am not a person who can tell you all the different episodes and all the titles and everything. And
I'm not quite that far, but I'm close to it.
So just bear with me on this. But what I really want to talk about is more the concept of knowing where you're going and what you're doing in TV. And what has confused me is that there's so much love and reverence for Who, which a lot of it is certainly warranted. It's been around for all this time. It's got generations behind it. But you would think that that would be paired with some sort of coherent storytelling. And it is not.
It never was.
And apparently it never was. So my complaint primarily is we get to the end of the – this is where this got started. We get to the end of the Christmas episode. We can no longer see River Song, boo-hoo, this is very sad, a lot of emotion. Oh, you can never see this character again. We love this character. We love this character with the Doctor. She's great. Why can't we see her again? Oh, and that's meant to be the tugging of the heartstrings. And when I mentioned this on Facebook to somebody who actually does know...
I watched that episode totally dry-eyed.
Oh, okay. I mean, I didn't boo-hoo either, but, you know, there are people who will certainly boo-hoo. And it's meant to tug at the heartstrings. That's the whole point of this ending.
Didn't do it for me.
I'm
very angry about River Song, and I'll go into that in a minute.
And I said, please explain to me why we can't see her again. He's got a time machine. We always see these characters come back again. And somebody explained it to me. She's a fixed point in time. She's got to go to the library now. And I'm like, I know I saw these episodes, but none of this is sticking. And then it just kind of blossomed from there where I'm thinking to myself, is Who badly written? Is Who just really not told well as much as we like it? And is this heresy? And are people going to, you know, storm me with little Tardeye and everything now? So that's where this came from.
Okay, the answer to your question is yes. Okay, which is to say, there are people who come in and break all the rules.
Mm-hmm.
There is no sense of continuity whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
And among the worst people who have worst practitioners of going past canon and beyond canon mm-hmm. and stuff like that is Neil Gaiman. Neil Gaiman has written two episodes of Doctor Who. And in one of them, he did a wonderful thing. He turned the TARDIS into a human. Mm-hmm. He humanized her.
I love that one. That was
it was lovely. But here's one question. Mm-hmm. How is the TARDIS his wife? It's not.
I thought it was metaphorical.
Well, then don't say it.
Also, I always took it as a sentient TARDIS as opposed to a human TARDIS. But maybe I missed the specific.
But, well, it has been pointed out to us in New Who any number of times that the TARDIS is sentient.
Okay, right.
And absolutely. We know that from the first series of New Who when Bad Wolf, the TARDIS, takes over Rose and corrects all of this stuff. And it happens again with Clara and happens left and right for good reasons, for bad reasons, usually for bad. But, you know, it's like, why couldn't she simply have been, the Doctor's sister or simply the Doctor's companion, another companion? It didn't have to be his wife. He also played fast and free with the Cybermen. Cybermen are slow and clunk, boom, 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 boom. And he made them faster than the Flash. Now, of course, they had to dial that one back. Mm-hmm. It's worse than DC Comics. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I was a kid and I read comics, which I don't much anymore, I watch them instead. When I was a kid, one of the things that I always noticed was that Marvel Comics, the front page and the inside teaser page, had a little something to do with the story. In DC Comics, that teaser had nothing. It never happened. The teaser never happened, and the fact that, now Clark works at a television station where he used to be, and he starts, and they reboot, and they reboot, and they do it so many times. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing with Who, and it seems to reboot almost every season. There are no rules. Mm-hmm. First of all, Who was off the air for no good reason for 17 years, having to do with the politics of the BBC. Mm-hmm. And during that time, it was basically taken over by fandom, by Whovian fans, Predonians, and I don't even know why they're called that, but that's the name of one group, and Gallifreyans and the Gallifrey Institute and all of that kind of stuff. And they started this series of audio dramas, some of which are very good. Mm-hmm. Called The Big Finish. And this is where they came up with the idea of the Time War.
Oh, okay.
The Time War does not exist in Doctor Who canon.
Ah,
it never existed. It's not there.
I was not aware of this.
But Russell Davis, who is the person who single-handedly is responsible for the reboot of Who,
picked up on that.
He came from that fandom. Mm-hmm. He was following the Big Finish radio plays and the novelizations and all of that. While Doctor Who was off the air, there were novels coming out, every year, and all of that. And they all built up to a war between the Time Lords and the Daleks.
Right.
By the time New Who comes around, and Christopher Eccleston's Doctor, the Ninth Doctor, says, "I'm the last of the Time Lords, boo-hoo." It's like, bull.
Well, here's the thing.
Do you know how many other Time Lords we have seen on that show? Okay, and that was a fixed point. Then, the Time War, right, is a fixed point.
Right.
Gallifrey is a fixed point. How many times have we gone to Gallifrey since New Who?
Right.
At least three.
I'm willing to go with the idea of, all right, we're rebooting it. In 2009, 2005, when was it?
2005. 10 years.
So 10 years ago, I'm willing to go with we're rebooting it. It's been quiet, quote unquote, for 17 years, and we're going to tell different story or new story or add or create.
But what they did was they took the non-canon material and made it canon.
But I'm not so bad with that, and I don't really mind so much that they make little changes along the way. But the bigger picture for me with Who, in addition, yes, the lack of consistency in storytelling is a big problem. But the other problem for me with Who is that you're using this invented story, which you change at the drop of a hat, to ratchet up the emotion. You're putting that amplifier on 11 so many times.
Especially Russell Davis.
Especially Russell Davis.
Moffat does it, but Russell Davis was the worst.
Right, that it loses its potency. I get, you want audience, you want people to tune in, you want people to talk about it, and is this the last time? But the problem is you can only say, the Doctor is definitely going to die. The universe is definitely going to
and
die.
And when you say, and die, not regenerate.
Right. You can only say that so many times. Yeah, die as
have you ever seen The Curse of the Fatal Death? The Curse of the Fatal Death is a Doctor Who episode written by Stephen Moffat that was aired on a British comedy night.
Oh, okay.
And it started out with, oh, who was the first Doctor in that one? I think it was Rowan Atkinson. And it was just absolute wonderful silliness. You can find it on YouTube.
Okay.
Called The Curse of the Fatal Death. It's about 20 minutes
I'm
long.
This down there.
And what would happen is the Doctor would touch something and he'd die and regenerate. And, oh, he turns into Hugh Grant. And, oh, now he's Richard Grant. And now he's Jim Broadbent. And now he's Jennifer Saunders. And all these wonderful British performers. And so, you see, there has been a woman as a Doctor, by the way. Lenny Henry was a Doctor. You know, now this is, again, not canon. But the Time War isn't canon either.
Right, but the special comedy stuff, we all know, that's not. But I guess my point is that I find it to be.
All I'm saying is that the inconsistency of it is parodied in there.
Right. So they're obviously cognizant of this. But I think that it is lazy storytelling and bad storytelling, separate from the whole consistency thing, to constantly put us in a state of ultimate jeopardy and then not follow through on it. And then try and do it again and again and again, because I've watched enough of these where I remember Matt Smith in the astronaut episode and Doctor,
which I did not care for.
I cannot change this. There is no way I can change this. I'm going to die. And the thing is, part of me is sitting there going,
and River's going to kill me.
Right. Of course he's not, because it's called Doctor Who. And all right, fine. But the worst that we can
your
expect
protagonist
is, maybe he'll have to
regenerate. You're already signed up for the next season. You know.
Yeah. It's and then the whole thing where, you know, the end of the world and the Daleks are sucking out every memory of that anybody ever had of existence. And I just feel like that weakens the show rather than strengthens it, because, you know, you're going to that soft spot so many times that it's just cheap. And, you know, own some of it. And I actually was looking some of this stuff up, and there's a whole discussion about, and this is Moffat specifically, but I'm sure it relates in other ways, which is that Moffat, he actually had a big giant reset button. You know, it's like he doesn't own death. He doesn't own grief. He doesn't own the concept of this character is done with. Now, there could be an exception, and spoiler alert, so leave the room and get a cup of coffee. Clara might, I mean, we know the actress has left the show. She might actually be dead, seriously dead, as opposed to dead, but on another plane of existence where Who just can't get to her at this moment.
But she's, you know, spoilers, she's not dead.
Well, but she's kind of dead.
Do
we not think that she's dead? Because from the final
episode. How about
episode,
the Doctor's daughter?
I'm confused now already. See, this is where I start.
That's the name of the episode.
The Doctor's daughter. Right.
And if you want to get really confused, follow this.
Uh-huh.
The Doctor's David Tennant, the 10th Doctor. Mm-hmm. The 10th Doctor puts his hand into some like cloning mechanism.
Oh, right, I remember that.
And it creates a clone, his daughter.
Right.
She is played by Georgina Moffat, not related to Stephen Moffat, different spelling.
Right.
She is, however, the daughter of Peter Davison, the 5th Doctor.
The 5th Doctor, right.
Now, to make matters worse, she and David Tennant have been married for about 5 years. They have four kids together.
Yeah, yeah.
So the 9th Doctor married his daughter, who is also the daughter of the 5th Doctor.
Right, the actor, though. I mean, we're not going in that direction, are we? I mean, you know.
I think we should, don't you? I mean, it's just like, if you want to deal with just, and her name is Moffat, how convoluted one can make this. It's wonderful.
Yeah.
But I mean.
It just feels
But the point is, at the end of that episode, It turns out she is the doctor's daughter, and they kill her off in a very weepy manner. And then after that, in the very final 30 seconds, we see that she takes a breath and there's the
right.
yellow color of regeneration.
But that's never followed up on.
But that's my point.
You think the Clara is
all
the...
All I'm saying is the doctor's daughter
uh-huh.
is out there with the TARDIS.
Right.
Clara is out there with a shoulder in a TARDIS.
Right.
The Master or Missy or whatever keeps dying and coming back. There's no way. River is a time traveler, so they can say boo-hoo, goodbye. All we know is that she dies.
Right.
In the episode The Silence of the Library or whatever it's called, and she gets put into the library, but she's living there. What pissed me off about that episode was mm-hmm. not what they did to River. Mm-hmm. What annoyed me was that Donna had lived an entire lifetime with this wonderful man who she met. They had kids. They lived this whole life. And as this episode is straightened out and we're back to the Whovian reality... The guy who's a stutterer sees her and tries to call out to her, but he stutters and she goes by. And at the end of the season where Donna is given the Superman Lois Lane kiss of forgetfulness,
mm-hmm.
which has annoyed every fan in the universe.
Well, that's the equivalent of, oh, it was only a dream.
Well, yeah, kind of thing. And if she ever knows it, I mean, mm-hmm. you know, that Donna is given absolutely no right, no legacy
mm-hmm.
of any kind whatsoever. I felt the very least they could have done for her was find her that guy from that episode with whom she had already had a life.
Right, right. That would have been a nice way to turn it around.
It really would have been. And what a few people arguing after the reading last night
mm-hmm.
were sitting around at a table arguing, good people too, were saying that was all Moffat trying to make up for Donna.
Mm.
And there's some truth to that.
Right.
Only they blame Moffat for it, and they have to remember, actually, it was Russell Davis
right.
who did that
right.
to Donna, not Moffat.
Yeah.
Moffat has his own crimes, too.
Yeah. I guess that's the thing. It's such a revered and long-lasting series with such a great character and a great basic setup that, you know, I wish that on some level that they just had it better organized, that they had it better thought through, that they said to themselves... All right, we've done this. We cannot then do that. But instead, it's we've done this. How do we find the loophole? What, you know, and how do we not, you know, how do we do something that'll let us do it anyway? And to me, that's not really good storytelling because there's no emotional heft. There's no long-term resonance because anything can be changed.
The doctor was limited to 12 lives. He's known as 13.
They change that too.
Yeah, because it's children's fantasy, and this is something that people forget, that as far as the BBC is concerned, they originally, and to an extent still, justify the program by saying the target audience originally was 8-year-olds, now they'll say, okay, 12-year-olds. But the idea, they used to actually have kids in the Christopher Eccleston, David Tennant eras. They had kids rating the shows, The Fear Factor and all that. It is supposed to be a kids' show. What happened after the first season, which is getting too darned adult with characters like Captain Jack, a metrosexual, I mean, basically if it moves, it's yours kind of guy, they infantilized the doctor when David Tennant came in. The first few episodes with him are really for little kiddies. If you mm-hmm. watch it carefully, you can see that. But what they gave Russell Davis to make up for it, Torchwood.
Right.
Which, by the way, I don't know why nobody's ever noticed that Torchwood is an anagram of Doctor Who.
I'm sure somebody's noticed that, but I hadn't. That's pretty good, actually.
It is. It's an anagram of Doctor Who.
That's awesome.
That's why it's called Torchwood. It's Doctor Who respelled.
Right. No, I never
heard
that.
And Torchwood was a wonderful show.
Yes.
And it would have had more of a life, except that Russell Davis's husband had brain cancer.
Oh.
and he needed to
focus on
have a life
right.
and focus on that. And the good news is, that was several years ago. As far as I know, mm-hmm. his husband is still alive and doing okay.
Oh,
so,
oh, that's good.
So, and he's back to writing, but he's left, you know, Moffat has tried to bring him back in, and all he's writing again.
Right. Well, you have heard, I mean, there was a recent Radio Times interview where Moffat was talking about he's actively looking for his successor.
You see, now that's nonsense.
Okay.
I read that original interview, that mm-hmm. whole thing, and they take it out of context. They also say Peter Capaldi was worrying about his regeneration. When Capaldi first took on the role, he said, "The moment I became Doctor Who, I started worrying about how would I regenerate." So then somebody quoted that a year later. And somebody else said, "Oh, this is going to be his last season." Sorry. No, not necessarily at all.
Right.
Moffat, all he did was he gave an interview saying, "I would not walk away from the show without making sure that it's in good hands and finding the right successor," such as Russell Davis did when he found me. Take that out of context. They take that interview out of context, and they said Stephen Moffat is looking for his successor.
Okay, so this is an old interview you're talking about.
Yes, yeah. Well, that's the thing, is that they revise it and bring it up out of the dead and quote it out of context, playing a game of telephone, and totally screwing up what was originally said.
Mm-hmm.
The original interview was in Radio Times. Go back, do a search, and you can find the actual original interview, the one that I referred to with Capaldi mm-hmm. and the one with Moffat, and read it in context. And Moffat said, "As far as I'm concerned, this can go on with Capaldi forever and me running it." And that's another quote. And why do people – and that's under a year old.
Mm-hmm.
He said that more recently.
Right.
Than he said anything about finding the successor.
Right. So let me ask if you...
And remember, by the way, if rule number one is the doctor lies,
mm-hmm.
rule number two is the showrunner lies.
Moffat lies, right. Well, let me ask you this, which is, and clearly there's a lot of inconsistency and changing of canon, and that sort of goes back to comic book days because, you know, people just, we have a new writer, we're going to reboot, all this kind of stuff. I get that. But in a lot of ways, these very strong fandoms do not put up with a lot of BS when it comes to their stories. You
mm-hmm.
know, there's a lot of outcry. There's a lot of people who are like, "This doesn't make any sense anymore. I'm just not going to watch it." You know, the whole Star Trek movie just came out, and people are parsing that for, "It's Riley." You know,
Star Wars. Yeah.
Star Wars. Thank you. I'm going to get stoned as soon as I leave. People are going to throw things at me. Star Wars just came
out. I'll get stoned as soon as I get home,
but I
do it in a different manner.
Right, exactly. and people are on top of that. Who's related to who? What, you know, they're very much on top of that. How is it that Who continues to fascinate, draw audiences, even get bigger, despite all of these massive flaws? All the way down
because
the
phone. Because they don't care. Because it doesn't take itself seriously.
Mm-hmm.
Star Wars does.
Mm-hmm.
That's another thing altogether. Star Wars takes itself way too seriously, even though it, too, shares with the Doctor Who the fact that it's not science fiction. It's science fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
It's not... the original Star Wars movie was an amalgam of all these serials
mm-hmm.
that Lucas had seen. Tatooine is Arrakis. It's from Dune. A lot of the plot line comes from The Star Kings by Edmond Hamilton,
mm-hmm.
who by coincidence happened to be married to one of the best writers in the world, a woman named Lee Brackett, who by coincidence is author of a movie called The Empire Strikes Back.
I thought Kasdan wrote that.
No. Lee Brackett wrote it, and she was 82 years old, and before the final draft, she died.
Oh, I see.
Of cancer.
So
Kasdan finished. No, they share the credit.
They share the credit, okay.
Just the same way as Lee Brackett shares the credit with William Faulkner for a movie she wrote called The Big Sleep.
Okay.
For Howard Hawks. And the basic myth on that is that Faulkner wrote it. But what a lot of people say is that Faulkner's head was like, you know, in a pool of bourbon, and she'd lift his head up occasionally and say, "Is this okay?" Go, "Yeah," and she'd put the head down. She wrote, as far as I'm concerned, The Big Sleep. She totally wrote The Long Goodbye for Robert Altman. Uh-huh. She wrote John Ford movies, Howard Hawke movies. Mm-hmm. And what's more, she wrote episode 2, mm-hmm. The Empire Strikes Back. I wish people would get their damned history right. There was no movie called A New Hope until a year and a half after Star Wars came out. Mm-hmm. It was a re-edit that made that happen, and also they improved the special effects at that time. but that Star Wars was a standalone, and then when Lee Brackett was hired to write the sequel, it was episode 2, The Empire Strikes Back, and she came up with The Revenge of the Jedi, mm-hmm. a film that was never made, where she envisioned the third film to largely take place on the Wookiee planet. Mm-hmm. But by this time, the marketers are in control of Lucasfilm, and they said, "You can't sell Wookiee toys."
Mini Wookiees.
Wookiee. How mini about, Wookiees. Why don't you take the name Wookiee and reverse it?
Ewookies.
Ewook. Ewok. Wookies.
It sounds like a computer thing now. Ewook.
Yeah, right. Does about.
But you know,
it's a theater on Times Square. By the way, Lister, where are you?
I'm sorry?
The fellow whose show starts in 2.5 minutes.
Oh, I
should have begun my outro theme a minute and a half ago.
Well, since he's not here, let me go on one tiny.
No, keep on going. I mean, until he's here, we're, you know.
So my Who related, my little, this is a little.
And Max, if you're listening, tell me what to put on the air.
Well, actually, before I even do that, since we have possibly another minute or two anyway.
Yeah.
Going back to something you just said a minute ago about Doctor Who not taking itself seriously.
Or the fans not taking it seriously. And
oh, okay, because I thought you were saying Doctor Who doesn't take itself seriously.
I think and to an extent, they don't necessarily. I mean, there is a certain, oh, who cares about it?
No pun intended.
I mean, come on. In one episode, they destroyed Big Ben.
Right.
In another episode, half of the Earth is standing on the edge of their buildings. Pardon me. Waiting to kill themselves. Mm-hmm. All the dead people from Earth arise.
Right.
And turn into Cybermen.
Right.
And nobody remembers this?
Right, we've all forgotten that later on. Well, you know, that's sort of like the nature of a procedural, where it's a self-contained episode, and the next after that, then we move on to the next thing, and nobody learns or grows, and that's fine.
Yeah.
But this show also asks us to absorb the idea that these things happen, and outside of that, people learn and grow, and here's a big speech and a big emotional moment about the nature of life and love and all that sort of thing. Okay, so...
Okay, that's Max, I think.
Okay. So...
Yeah, so what should I put on the air?
Have a call in, listeners.
Okay. You know what? I'm going to turn off my mic.
I'll go into my little mini rant thing, yeah. And I'll catch Jim up on this once he's focusing again.
My
mini rant is going back to the Christmas special we just saw with the river that ends with River Song and the Doctor hanging out. But we start in the beginning of the episode very far in the future, not 10 years, not 15 years. You know, I can't even remember the date. I tried to look this up, can't find the exact date. But we're starting a significant period of time in the future. Okay, great. I get it's a Christmas special, and I get that the Brits take Christmas seriously in a way that, you know, even American audiences don't. I understand all of this. But, you know, how do you